Welcome to KPMG's podcast series on the interaction of tax and ESG, environmental, social, and governance. I'm your host, Brett Weaver, tax lead for KPMG's ESG services. Our ESG solutions enhance and empower your sustainability initiatives. We assist companies to unlock new value as they build a sustainable future. In this new mini-series, we focus on tax ESG. My guests and I will explore the role of tax in a company's overall ESG strategy. Joining me today are Richard Marcos, Global Head of Credits and Incentives for KPMG, and Nicole DeJager, Senior Leader in our EU Decarbonization Center of Excellence. Welcome, guys.
Thanks, Brett. It's great to be here.
Thanks, Brett.
Glad to have you with us. Let's just jump right into it, guys. So, first question that I think it'd be great to kind of set the stage for our audience, and that is, I think as we all know, governments have long used tax as a social and industrial engineering tool. We certainly saw that during the pandemic. You know, many governments, including the U.S., used tax to keep employees on the payroll, even though, you know, a lot of businesses were contracting pretty significantly. So, you know, governments can certainly choose between the use of incentives, disincentives, or both to accomplish their social and industrial engineering objectives. Richard, I think I'd like to start with you. Can you provide a little color on the tools in the toolbox, so to speak, that governments use at their and have at their disposal as it relates to building a more sustainable future?
Sure. On the one side of the sword, as you called it, the double-edged sword, you have taxes and reporting, and I'll defer to Nicole to talk a little bit about that. But on the other side, you're going to see some of the items that are more like rewards for certain types of behavior. And depending on which part of the world you're in, you might see more of the sticks versus the carrots, so to speak. But if we focus just on the incentives, you're going to see a number of tools in the toolbox there. And just to name a few, you can open up your tax code and see that there's already existing statutory credits that have been placed in that code to incentivize certain types of behavior like green energy, hiring, et cetera. There's also what we call discretionary credits. And some of these will come and go based on a very specific goal of that government, meaning that they're focused on trying to incentivize one specific action. So they could push all the funds towards that in a very small window of time. And once those funds are gone, they're gone. Another thing we're seeing is the use of non-tax cash grants. And while we don't see as many of these in the US, we do see more of these in Europe and Australia. And then finally, the last piece that we're seeing being used as an incentive is what we call negotiated incentives. And these are very interesting as well, because it's sort of you go in and make your own package. You sit down with the government and negotiate. If we do X, then you will reward us with Y. And those are very interesting approaches as well. But when you put them both together, hopefully they're striking the right balance for setting policy within the budgetary framework that the government has to work with.
Thanks, Richard. I think it's really interesting, as you point out, that the use of these different tools might differ across various regions around the globe. Probably a good opening for you, Nicole. Why don't you share your perspective of, you know, what governments are doing more generally?
Sure. Thanks, Brett. So the tools that governments have at their disposal to build a more sustainable future does really depend on the country's specific economics and also the socio-political factors. So the content of the toolbox will differ between countries and regions. And because building a sustainable future is such a broad topic, as it essentially encompasses every aspect of the economy, what may work for one sector may require a different approach for a different sector. So the specific tools in the toolbox might differ between sectors. So for instance, heavy emitters may face more disincentives, such as taxes or penalties, to drive the sustainability agenda. Whereas it's more likely that, for instance, vehicle owners will be offered tax deductions or relief or funding to change behaviors. So that being said, and Richard has already alluded to the different incentives, the commonly used tax-related tools that we see in place are related to personal or corporate income tax, tax wage reliefs, excise duty refunds, exemptions or reductions, VAT exemptions and reductions. There's also carbon taxes and other forms of carbon pricing. And specific to the environment, are taxes that encompass waste, landfills, electricity and electricity use, water usage, petroleum and other fossil fuels, air pollution, and also plastics. So it's quite an extensive list, but this list isn't exhaustive. It's just the ones that we see are being most commonly applied by governments across many jurisdictions.
Well, thanks, Nicole. As you and Richard both walked through that, that toolbox is even bigger than I thought it was. There's a lot of tools in there for sure. Let me stay with you, Nicole. Maybe we can, start to get a little bit more specific on what we're seeing in different parts of the world. And let's start with you in Europe. Certainly, Europe seems to have been a leader with government out front on sustainable efforts, using tax as a major theme. What are you seeing specifically, in Europe now as it relates to government stimulus and possibly new environmental taxes?
So it's the European Union's ambition for Europe to become the first carbon neutral continent by 2050. The goal that is driving the big themes that we are seeing playing out in Europe when it comes to government stimulus or environmental taxes is really this ambition that the European Union has. Underpinning all of this is the introduction of the European Green Deal in 2019, which consists of dedicated regulations, strategies, and funding mechanisms in respect of 8 major policy areas that are all designed to work together to achieve the 2050 net zero ambition. Embedded in the European Green Deal is a set of legislative proposals, dubbed Fit for 55, that were introduced in 2021 and are designed to revise and update the European Union's climate, transport, land use, energy, and taxation policies with its 2030 milestone of cutting net greenhouse gas emissions by at least 55% when compared to 1990 levels. Specific to environmental taxes at a European Union level is the proposed extension to the current emissions trading system, which is an European market for emissions rights based on a cap and trade system. The revision would essentially entail extending the covered sectors to include maritime transport, a one-off reduction in the overall allowance cap, and the phasing in of free allowances. The expanding ETS is also related to a new self-standing emissions trading system for the building and road transport sectors. Now, tied to the revision of this trading system is the proposed introduction of the carbon border adjustment mechanism, the key objective of which is to ensure that the price of imports accurately reflects their carbon content, thereby preventing carbon leakage, which would happen when purchasers switch suppliers or manufacturers move production from a high tax or regulation jurisdiction to one with lower regulation so as to reduce cost. The effect is that carbon emissions really just shift from location and are not reduced. There's also the proposed revision of the EU's Energy Taxation Directive, which lays down the minimum excise duty rates for the taxation of energy products used. The revision would ensure that fuels most harmful to the environment are taxed the most, and that's by taxing fuels according to their energy content and environmental performance rather than their volume. Then we also have the European Union's own resource plastics contribution, which has been in place since the 1st of January 2021. Member states are obliged to contribute to the EU budget for plastics packaging based on the national amount of non-recycled plastic packaging waste produced by each member state. It is, however, up to each member state to decide whether or not they will introduce their own in-country plastics tax to design their own tax legislation. At the moment, there are only 3 European countries that have actually enacted a plastics packaging tax: the UK since the 1st of April 2022, and Italy and Spain from 2023. The EU also has in place a number of funding mechanisms totaling over 1 trillion euros that are in place to facilitate and finance the European Green Deal and ensure a just and inclusive transition. So the goal there is to transform EU member states from a high to low carbon economy without reducing prosperity. If we look at the individual member state level, the big themes that we see are in play are increases in excise duties and carbon taxes, and incentives for investments in green energy products and incentives in relation to efficient travel.
Thanks, Nicole. That's really fascinating as you walk through what's happening in Europe. You know, I find it interesting that Europe has seemed to have leaned into environmental taxes, certainly much more than we've seen in the US. Why is that?
I think that what it might relate to is the fact that we have the European Union. So you have the different 27 member states all working towards a common goal. Right from the beginning, or at least from the early 2000s, Europe has already had quite a few policies and procedures in place to drive the sustainable environmental agenda. So instead of this legislation being something completely new, what we're seeing is a revision and recast of existing directives and regulations with an increased ambition. So where you might have different countries in other regions looking to introduce entirely new regulations, this is something that is not new to Europe. It's just increasing the ambitions that are already there.
Gotcha. Richard, what's your take?
We see this sometimes that when a country is well advanced in towards a specific policy, you start to switch from the incentives to the taxes. And I think when we look at Europe, Europe has gotten a little further ahead of us along with the climate change policy. And I do believe that even though there still are many incentives in Europe, you know, the taxes seem to be the second point, not the starting point. You know, what I might see in the US is as we progress as well, we might switch to more taxes as opposed to incentives.
Gotcha. Yeah, interesting background on that one. And Richard, let me pick up with where you just left off then, right? The U.S. seems to be throwing a little bit of money around from an incentive standpoint. You know, many have hailed the recently enacted Inflation Reduction Act in the United States as one of the most significant investments in renewable energy that we've ever seen. So let's dive into the act a little bit. What should we all be paying attention to as it relates to the incentives that we find in the Inflation Reduction Act?
I got to tell you, Brett, this Inflation Reduction Act is quite revolutionary. I've been doing this for 22 years, and I've never seen anything like this, from the magnitude of the credits, from the approach to the credits, to all the different innovations that they've put in there. It's really quite exciting. We all know from the beginning that this administration was very focused on climate change. So we see that front and center. And if you weren't thinking about it before, this act will force you to think about it. First of all, it's split into a few different areas. And when you look at all those areas combined, they nearly touch almost every company in the country. First, obviously, we have incentives for those that are generating renewable energy. Next, we see incentives for those that are in the supply chain of renewable energy, down to the equipment, the panels, the blades, even the raw materials that go into some of these projects. Finally, there's even incentives for those that are consuming renewable energy. So electric vehicles, charging stations, building energy efficient buildings, et cetera. Second, they've done something very different and interesting in that in some of these credits qualify for what's called direct pay. And what that does, it allows a taxpayer to monetize them even if they don't have any tax liability. And that's a total game changer. In addition, some of the credits qualify for transferability, which allows a taxpayer to sell their credits even if they don't have capacity to use the tax credits. This opens the net much wider in incentivizing more startup companies or companies that have not yet generated enough revenue to be taxable. Finally, one other thing that's very interesting about this act is that while many of these credits focus on the E of ESG, they've also added an interesting twist, which we're calling sweeteners. And these sweeteners focus more on the S of ESG. So let me give you an example. You've got your standard investment tax credit for developing renewable energy generation. It used to be that this credit was just a standard 30%. Well, now you start off with a 6% credit, and then you get an additional credit if you can show that you've paid prevailing wages and you've used apprenticeships in the construction of your project. We see additional sweeteners related to development in low-income census tracts, other ones related to using domestic content. So again, very different approach that seems to hit two birds with one stone.
Yeah, Richard, I think it's really interesting. One of the things you pointed out that, you know, a lot of companies I've talked to, their initial impression is that the act really focuses on producers of clean energy, but as you pointed out, even consumers of clean energy, there's money there as well, right? And are you finding the same thing that, you know, it's a journey for companies to really understand how, you know, they may benefit from the act?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of our clients said the same thing, but then you start to look at the footprint of your building and understanding that, well, we have a fleet. We're going to switch our fleet now to from fossil fuel to electric. We've got charging stations for our employees. All of those things, while they're not, you know, front and center in generating, they are a part of the piece of the pie. We're helping our clients understand that if they're embarking on any of these projects, there could be some incentives in this act for them.
Great. Thanks, Richard. I think where I'd like to go now is businesses, right, that are really investing pretty significantly in more sustainable operations. And that's from supply chain, you know, all the way through just their operating model, right? So much of this investment is really aimed at greening their supply chains, improving their operations from an environmental perspective. And this is certainly purpose-led, but it's also fueled by these new climate, you know, related taxes and incentives you've talked about. It's also fueled by new disclosure rules, right? Recently, we've seen the SEC, you know, weigh in with new rules that we'll have shortly in the US. In Europe, we have the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. So let me ask you, in light of all this that's going on from a government perspective and as companies are leaning in to green their supply chains, how should companies think about the role of tax more generally as their businesses make these types of investments? Nicole, let me start with you.
We often view tax only as an outward flow of funds, but I think that we need a change in our perspectives and perceptions towards tax when we start asking suddenly what tax can do for us. So if I had to add in the word incentives to a tax conversation, this starts piquing interest. Governments use tax as a stick and carrot tool. So the carrot comes in the form of tax incentives. And the role of tax in developing sustainable business strategies and investing in operations should probably be seen in a more positive light. So we encourage businesses to explore what tax incentives are available to them to achieve these strategies and objectives. To highlight just a few examples, and obviously this will differ between jurisdictions, some countries offer reduced VAT rates on photovoltaic installations. There are excise duty exemptions on electricity generated from renewable energy sources or accelerated depreciation for energy efficient equipment. Of course, the landscape is far more extensive than this, both across and within different countries. Just to make this example more concrete, South Africa has in place an energy efficiency allowance to encourage entities to improve their energy efficiency and show measurable energy savings, thereby contributing to sustainability. Taxpayers under this allowance are entitled to a tax deduction of 95 cents per kilowatt hour or kilowatt hour equivalent of energy efficiency savings from non-renewable energy sources. So if, for instance, a manufacturing entity is looking to expand their operations or even revamp their existing plant, it would make sense to include the energy efficiency of new equipment or even lighting in their investment decision if this means that they receive an additional tax allowance as a result. So I really do think that this should be explored by businesses more as they do make these business strategies and investment decisions, as this is often an area that is quite overlooked, but can be very beneficial to them.
Yeah, that's a great example, Nicole. It really brings it home. Richard, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to understand how these taxes and incentives impact future ESG projects. It's definitely an area that requires a cross-functional team. So while tax has a role, it's very important what we're seeing from some of our clients. They're creating teams with public relations, legal, operations, but it is important for tax to be involved as well. We see this as the best approach because each stakeholder has their own valuable input on how these items will impact the company, and tax is no exception, especially to help navigate those items that are part of the tax code. The last point I want to make on this is that the best practices we are seeing are to make sure these discussions are happening before the money is spent. So still while the design of the ESG project is in flight, before the contracts are written, we've seen many opportunities to slightly change the term of a contract or an approach, which results in saving millions of dollars of taxes but it needs to be incorporated up front.
Thanks, Richard. I mean, that's a great take-home point, right, that you both made is, you know, as companies are spending a lot of money and retooling, you know, what they do and how they do it, the tax should have a seat at the table. That's a really good examples from both of you. Hey, as we wrap up here, I think I'd like to throw out kind of a fun question, and I'm going to ask you both to look into your crystal ball, so to speak, and look out 5 years from today. And the question I want to ask you is, will the role that government plays that's aimed towards sustainability look different than it does today? And so what's your prediction? Nicole, let me start with you.
I think that the role that government plays largely depends on business and consumer behaviors and trends. So the more that consumers and businesses take it upon themselves to act in an increasingly sustainable manner and continue to build on what is already achieved, the less intervention from government is required. At the moment, though, I think that a push from governments is still needed. Now, 5 years goes by very quickly. So I think that the role that government plays will probably increase in terms of intervention measures, but won't necessarily differ vastly from what we see today.
Thanks, Nicole. Richard, what's your take?
I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. Everywhere we look, we're seeing more and more credits and incentives being used to drive the ESG space. But I think in the future, what we'll see is more of the same, however, probably a lot more very specific programs that will focus on those specific areas of ESG that are lacking, depending on which part of the world you're in. But my guess is we'll also see a lot more in the cash grant and refundable credit space. What will make it even more interesting to see how these credits evolves is how we enter into the world of Pillar 2 and the distinction between those credits that are taken into consideration for above the line versus below the line taxes.
Thanks, Richard. Yeah, you really opened a Pandora's box there referring to Pillar 2, right? So maybe that'll be the topic of another future podcast. There's a lot to unpack there for sure. Well, hey, thanks, Richard and Nicole. It's been a fascinating discussion. I really appreciate both of you joining us today and sharing your expertise and insights. You're some really good information and pointing us, I think, to where we all ought to be thinking as we have our tax hats on and helping business to accomplish what they're trying to do in more sustainable efforts about how we all do business. So for our audience, please join me next time on our Tax ESG podcast series. We've got another exciting episode teed up for you. In the meantime, if you have any questions, please feel free to send me an email. My email address is baweaver, that's baweaver at kpmg.com. Also, please check out our KPMG ESG webpage at visit.kpmg.us/impact. And there you can sign up for our ESG alert to get the latest insights on ESG. Thank you for joining us today.